we find that we wasted contributor dollars by wasting time by sitting in meetings of coalitions and having arguments with people over what do you believe or what do you think or how do you describe this. And our practice has been to have as few meetings as possible and pretty much avoid all of that, and instead have working group meetings where we sit down and the discussion topic is, what are we going to do together? And it's very focused on practice. And for me, I feel, or my approach has been, there really isn't any hope. If you're in despair and you're asking, is there any hope? No, there is no hope. Hope isn't a noun. And it's not something you can have. It's not something you can lose. It's not something you can hand somebody else. It's a practice. So if you practice hope, then it comes into the world. And how do you practice hope? I don't think you practice hope by discussing ideas and arguing with each other who has the better way to say something. You bring hope into the world by getting things done. And as you accomplish things together, that's what takes on importance. So you could have, and we did have, 125 groups, and some of them had very strong frictions between them. And if we talked about that, we would never have gotten anything done. But in the U.S. campaign to ban landmines, we made a major contribution to getting the United States to stop using landmines. And that was what was important, and we focused everybody's attention on that. And similarly, getting a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. People have a lot of different views on that, but actually that goal is something that brings a lot of people of different views together. So we are always trying to figure out how can we name a thing to be done that would invite a lot of people in.
If I understand correctly, you're trying to argue for maybe a different understanding of what it would mean to be a lobbyist. You're lobbying for peace, which is not something that normally, at least in Washington, one thinks of when one thinks of lobbying. If I'm understanding correctly, you're trying to argue for a relationship between activism and lobbying. Mm-hmm. Is that correct, or how would you define these terms?
Yes, I think that's correct. I see myself as a practitioner, working in Washington, D.C., as a nonpartisan, nonprofit Quaker lobby in the public interest. It's very demanding, a lot of activity. One does feel, as one of my colleagues said, as you're doing this work, it's as if you were in an emergency room of a hospital when there was a natural disaster and people are coming in to the emergency room all the time. And you don't really have time to think about what you're doing. You need to have thought about that a long time ago. You need to have been put your concepts together, your ideas together, and you just have to respond to the situation and hope what you're doing is correct. So another person has described the work as like drinking from a fire hydrant. There's so much information, so much analysis going on. Well, that's one aspect of the environment. But in terms of lobbying, I think most people think of a lobbyist as someone who is a hired gun for a corporation. And the corporation has money, and because the corporation has money, the corporation can affect the public message, the mass media message. And the corporation, because it has access to a lot of different pockets of money, it also can deliver votes. And if you're a nonprofit, public interest organization, that's not where your power can come from. So as a lobbyist in the public interest, ordinary civil society, not corporate power, we have to find other sources of power, and that source of power is an awakened, activated public at the community base and communities all over the country, and who are not only awakened and concerned, but they'll actually do something. And I'll say one more thing, and I'll try to stop to see if I'm speaking to the question you're asking. An awful lot of money is put into public interest lobbying and is completely wasted, in my view. Money put into studies that sit on shelves that never get read or used. Money that is used to, the way it's put, is educate and persuade the public of some point of view. And I think the public polling, for instance, PIPA, the Project on International Policy Attitudes, indicates that, for the most part, the public already either is educated or has already adopted a point of view that we want to that we would want to persuade people. They're already persuaded. So putting money into that is a waste. What you want to do is mobilize people. And I think there is a tremendous despair that Congress just can't be moved. It's in gridlock. It can't be moved. Corporations have all the power. And our experience is quite the contrary. If you mobilize a public, Congress does get moved. And they're surprised. They surprise themselves. They don't believe that was possible. So as a practitioner of lobbying, I think our focus has very much been on trying to identify who in communities, congressional districts and states, care about things, and how can we mobilize them on time.
Do you see that as related to the work of an activist? Do you identify with kind of a history of peace activism, or is that something that you distinguish from your work as a lobbyist?
Yeah. Okay, now at the end of what I say here, I'm going to try to get over to art. But I see it as related to activism, and as I've said in several presentations that some people have been at here, I became unsatisfied with activism. I tried activism as an individual in the Army trying to organize people to refuse to go to Vietnam. And I didn't go to I refused to go to Vietnam, got court-martialed, but it didn't stop the Army. And I was that was not good. I got involved in nonviolent direct action and did blockades of munitions carriers, aircraft carriers, did a lot of work to try to stop wars, and I think it was important to do, but I didn't see it changing policy. So what I got interested in was how do you translate people's protest into policy? What was the mechanism? And I've been saying to groups here that it seems to me that activists tend to be of two kinds. Of course, there are two kinds of people, those who think there are two kinds of people and those who don't. So I recognize that. But for the purpose of making this argument, I say there are activists who see the glass as half empty. And those activists, I think, tend to focus on problem definition, and they can describe in great detail what's wrong. And that if you look at what they're doing, you might get the impression that they believe the louder and more often you say what's wrong, the more likely policy is going to change. But actually, it doesn't. And then the other kind of activist is the activist glass half full. And they see where you want to go. They see the solution. And they can describe it in detail. And again, they think, well, if I just say it a lot and I keep saying it louder, policy will change. But it doesn't. And why not? It's because, in my view, there's a huge gap between the problem definition and the solution. Mm-hmm. And that gap has to be filled by a change strategy. Mm-hmm. What is your strategy for walking us from here to there? And then we see some of us, not everybody, but some of us who work on change strategies to get from the problem definition to the solution will look at Congress and say, you know, basically Congress is a body of 535 bus drivers. What are bus drivers supposed to do? They're supposed to get you from your point of origin to your destination. They're supposed to get you from the problem definition to the solution. So if your bus driver has gone off route and the bus isn't going where it's going, you passengers ought to get up and go grab the attention of the bus driver and say, hey, get back on the route. Otherwise, we're not going to get to our destination. And so we're trying to mobilize passengers in the national bus to get the attention of these bus drivers and get us back on the road. Now, to get back to art, I remember when I came out of the Army and I started getting involved in activism, we went out on the street, this was in Ohio, to do some demonstrations to try to get people's attention. I used a poem about war on a flyer. And it was an old World War I A.E. Hausman poem about a soldier who died, or soldiers who died in World War I. And it said, "Here dead lie we, because we did not choose to live, and shame the land from which we sprung. Life, to be sure, is nothing much to lose, but young men think it is, and we were young." And I just thought, anybody who reads that poem has just got to understand Vietnam, you know, what's this terrible waste. And all of my colleagues said, "What a waste of paper. This has nothing to do with political change. Throw that away." And we got threw that away, and we got something completely different. But I was quickly turned away from the arts to the practice of other kind of nonviolent direct action and activism, because I didn't see. They convinced me that art wasn't a force for change. I think maybe you've got another vision about what art is.
Well, in the arts, it's always difficult because one doesn't want to instrumentalize concepts.
Right?
I'm fundamentally committed to the idea of peace, but at the same time, the question is, how do you not just instrumentalize peace as a tool?
Does that mean art can't be art if it's put to a purpose?
I think that that's an ongoing question and tension, right? What are the limits? You know, fundamentally, I'm interested in the arts insofar as it's related to the concept of imagination. What's so difficult for me about the political is that the political isn't always that imaginative.
Yes.
In Washington, for instance.
Right.
Which is precisely what I would argue it needs to be more of, right? It needs to hold on to the concept of imagination.
Right.
It needs to hold on, in other words, to the concept of literature, to the literary, to the poetic.
Right.
And so for me, that's always the question. How do you insert back into a society, not just Washington perhaps, but how do you insert into a society that's lost, perhaps to some degree, that concept? How do you insert the imaginative back in, the potential back in? Because there is something very political about imagining things different than the way they are.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the same politics or understanding of politics that may be as a lobbyist you work towards in the immediate sense.
So there's something very political about art. I'm putting words in your mouth to test whether I'm hearing you right.
Yeah.
Because when you experience art, you experience a question, why or why not, or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. It's on the side of questioning rather than legislating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's also, I think, a different temporal dimension.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, a colleague of mine, Eduardo Cadava, and I have been thinking a lot about questions of time. And when it comes to the arts, or when it comes to, like, let's talk, like, let's imagine we're talking about the future, because both of us have a vested interest in the future being different than it is right now.
Right.
Whether it's based on what's happening in Afghanistan or what's happening with regard to the digital divide in Philadelphia, one way or the other, I'm sure we both have a concept of the future. I mean, for me, the danger is to want to define the future in advance.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't want the future to be something that I've defined already, because then it's not the future. It's just a prolongation of the present or of myself.
Right.
Whereas in your work, you very much, you have a goal, an outcome, and you're trying to work towards that future.
That's right.
I feel like maybe that's another way of talking about the difference between our perspectives.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, before we got here, we were talking about the Slott Foundation and how it came to work on the Kant essay. And you described a process.
Maybe
you'll describe that in just a minute. But it reminded me of a process of how we came to have the international campaign to ban landmines. So in that process, we had practitioners from different organizations, from veterans organizations and from humanitarian aid organizations, and they just happened to meet over beer and a lunch in Germany on the occasion of some other meetings. And they said, you know, we are spending gobs of money to deal with victims of landmines and survivors of landmines, and we just can't keep up. What we need to do is have a collaboration among all our organizations to get a ban so that states will not be permitted to use landmines anymore. And then we can catch up. We can start eliminating landmines, and eventually we'll reduce the number of casualties every year. And so it was out of practice on the ground, and practice on the ground revealing a bigger problem than any one of them could address, that they got to the point of saying, well, we've got to have this collaboration, and let's work together and figure out how to do that. And then we went on and developed a strategy to get the global ban. But when you described your process, there was a collaborative discovery similar, it seemed to me. Oh, we need to collaborate. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know. We could talk about process a great deal, and probably I would not give you a clear sense of our process after many hours of talking about it. But our process is not always so targeted. Often there's a conversation about something that leads to a conversation about something else, which leads to a project, which is generative of another project. So it's more meandering. It's less focused in its direction. Although it may, to the public, result in various projects, documents that seem like we anticipated that project from the very beginning. So I don't know if that answers your question, but our process is fundamentally one of curiosity. And curiosity doesn't always have like a clear path that it follows.
You don't know where you're going, whereas the process I described, we didn't know if we'd get there, but we knew where we were trying to go. And we were going to try to organize things to make that happen.
There's probably something very similar, though, at the same time to both of our processes in the process of working on that ban on landmines. That led you to think differently, probably, about possibilities for collaboration, about what would be your next goal or project. And so there's probably something similar as well at the same time. But we're also a bit self-reflective. So like, we spend a great deal of time thinking about, like, how do you orchestrate the conversation? How do you make sure the conversation's inclusive? How do you literally spatialize the project? So we're very self-reflexive. And it was interesting when you first started speaking and you talked about your work as a lobbyist. You didn't seem to say that it was self-reflexive. You seemed to say that you had 24 hours in the day.
Self-reflective or self-reflexive? And what's the difference between
both?
The two?
I don't know, that's a good question what the difference is. I would want to hold on to both. Meaning I would want to, on some level, be fundamentally ambivalent about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
and change it, calibrate it constantly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is that in lobby work. And I was saying to a group in my first week that I think one characteristic of the work we do is that we recognize that, to put it in religious terms, doubt ministers to faith. But if you put it in management terms, you always have to be assessing, is this the right use of our scarce resources? Mm-hmm. Is it getting us mm-hmm. what we said we were going to do? So you keep looking at that.
So I want to hold on to this then. So can you talk more about how you negotiate on a daily level or in your practice more generally? How do you negotiate the theological and the philosophical and the managerial?
Uh-huh.
Like, it seems like, in a way that's unlike like the work that I do, you're negotiating different paradigms of thought.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, let me take being a governed organization as part of the question. Let me take using contributor dollars effectively as another one. And third, let me talk about trying to be an effective lobbyist, actually achieving what you set out to do. So theologically, in a way, a Quaker lobbyist doesn't have a problem because there's no creed, there's no doctrine, right? But the problem comes in where the Quaker lobbyist is accountable to a community of faith, and it's the community of faith that governs the practice of the organization. And so you have the governors, in our case, 200 members of the Religious Society of Friends, who meet annually and set our budget, write our policy, name our legislative priorities for our Congress, and decide who's the head of the organization. So that's the governing process. And they do that every year, and then they name people to have quarterly meetings to watch the whole thing. As head of the organization, I hire a staff. And it's a Quaker operation. Not everybody on staff is Quaker, but it's a Quaker organization. But if we ran the staff group as a governed organization like that, then how could we be accountable to the decisions the board made? Because the staff group might be coming up with different decisions. And so there you have to run the organization with some hierarchy. And staff are accountable to the head of the organization, and the head of the organization is accountable to the governors. And that takes time. You know, it takes a lot of time to work all of that out. And in order to run a lobby, a nonprofit lobby, you have to be very savvy about business. And you have to know how to run a nonprofit like the most effective business. It has to be efficient.
Entrepreneurial, almost.
Right. Yeah. I am glad you mentioned that, because a lot of people escaped to the nonprofit arena years ago to get away from the entrepreneurial pressures. But if you're not an entrepreneur in a nonprofit, your nonprofit's dead. I mean, it's going to be toast, because you just can't keep up unless you have a huge endowment that is never going to go away.
But you don't mean entrepreneurial in the financial sense. You mean it in the sense of what an organization can be as a platform, in a way.
I mean it in both senses. You cannot do good lobbying work, and I would suspect any kind of nonprofit work, if you're not good at raising money. And if you're not good,
you're in trouble.
You got to raise money, and you got to know how to get it invested, and you got to know how to build it. And you got to know how to use budgets as a planning tool, and you need multiple year budgets. If I was going to go at this again as a young person, I'd go get an MBA from some really smart school. But yes, in lobbying, you have to be an entrepreneur to figure out how do you break through the noise. Congressional Management Foundation does studies of Congress. And in 2006, I think they found that 535 members of Congress received 295 million individual messages. And when there are that many messages going to 535 members of Congress, it just all becomes noise. How could you possibly respond to that as a member? But also, if you're sending the messages, how could you possibly get a member of Congress to pay attention to your message?
So what's your answer to that?
Well,
What's your strategy?
We do have a strategy, and I'll use one illustration. We were pretty confident that Obama, after he got elected, would push for a nuclear disarmament treaty. We thought initially it would be comprehensive test ban. Turned out it was going to be renewal of the New START treaty, strategic arms reduction talks. And our strategy to break through the noise was to say, we will be wasting our time and we'll be ineffective if we try to affect 535 members of Congress. Why? Well, for the 435 of them have nothing to do with ratification of treaty. Get rid of them. That's the House. You don't have to deal with the House. Now you have 100 senators. And working on 100 senators, that's still too many. But you don't have to work with most of them because most of them are not on the Foreign Affairs Committee and most of them are not on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So pretty much take the senators who aren't on those committees and then look at those two committees and say, of those two committees, how many are already with you? Okay, we don't have to work on them. Mm-hmm. How many of them are adamantly against you and will never change their mind no matter what? Well, it's worthless to work on them. And then you look at how many members are left, mm-hmm. and you say, of them, how many would we need in order mm-hmm. to win? And say, okay, that's where we focus our energy. And that's how you break through the noise.
But that doesn't seem very consensus-driven.
What's that?
That approach. It seems like it's not about consensus at all. It's about identifying kind of key figures, in a sense.
Yes, when you're in working with Congress, and I would guess this is true probably at the state level with the state legislature, there are so many different issues mm-hmm. that a legislature is dealing with. Very few members are going to know about all of them. Mm-hmm. No member is going to know about all of them. And what happens is certain members emerge as, oh, they're the ones who know. And all the other members wait to see, well, what are they going to do? And they sort themselves out. Well, I'm going to follow this one. I'm going to follow that one. There are exceptions to what I just said, but you can be an effective lobbyist pretty much working on that principle. And yes, it isn't a consensus in the sense that everybody in the Senate is thinking deeply about the New START Treaty. But yes, it is a consensus if you succeed at getting 2/3 or more of members of the Senate to vote for something. And I think we got 72 instead of 67, so that was pretty good in this case. We got 72. Well, for a Senate, that's pretty much a consensus. But I take your point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a different kind of question. Kant warns in Perpetual Peace about defining peace and war in opposition to each other. He said that's not subtle enough in a way. Uh-huh. And we're always caught up in war, such that peace in that definition always gets deferred. I was wondering if you could speak about this present that we're living in. It's a moment when what peace means is really unclear. Uh-huh. We have various contingencies, groups, parties, and others claiming peace,
right.
but often for ends that you or I might think of as antithetical.
Right.
We define peace. So, I mean, it's been decades now that you have been committed to working towards peace. Do you feel like your definition of peace has changed? Do you feel like these other definitions are just not accurate definitions? Like, how do you deal with the terminological confusion? Where even somebody like Obama, who gets the Peace Prize, has a just war theory that enables him to wage war, for instance, in the name of peace. Like, how do we, in this terminologically confused moment, talk about peace, and how do you talk about it?
Right. Well, first, let's take your phrase, how do you talk about peace? And this isn't directly responsive to your question, but it's context. It is interesting to me when we look at the writing and the speaking of people who are in peace organizations, how belligerent their language is. I mean, it's very common to talk about how are we going to have a barrage of arguments that are going to kill our opponent? How are we going to target this person? How are we going to target a congressional district? It is pervasive, these pugilist metaphors and analogies and words in our language. And when I have a new staff person come to FCNL or have an intern come to FCNL, I always say, in your first year here, I want you to, you know, do your writing or do your speaking, and then afterwards I want you to look at it and think, was your language demilitarized? And because we really are going to have to demilitarize just about everything if we're going to have a democracy. You have to demilitarize for democracy. Let's start with our language. And people say, well, you just can't talk about it unless you talk that way. Everybody knows what you mean. They know you don't mean to, that you don't literally mean that. They say, well, if you don't, why don't you just say what you mean instead of what you don't mean? And this is a very hard discipline for people to accept, but once they do, I think it opens up horizons that people did not see before. I think that we have a very militarized society, a very militarized government, and therefore peace gets defined pretty much as pre-war or post-war. And the war is what gets us to the next pre-war and post-war. when you look at the military budget and you look at the whole federal budget, it's every year now between 39 and 42% of the whole federal budget. So the peace in congressional terms has meant how much military power do we have and how much are we spending on it. Peace through strength is the way they put it. And what we've said is war is not the answer, and peace is possible through peaceful means. And what are those peaceful means? And we have a repertoire of available practices any nation could engage in, but particularly the U.S., that we call peaceful prevention of deadly conflict. And the Carnegie Corporation has published about 35 volumes collecting what practitioners know about peaceful prevention of deadly conflict. So it's not unknown. I mean, there's a lot of information about this. So when we're talking to members of Congress and congressional staff about peace, one of the things we find ourselves saying is, when you, the member of Congress, talk about defense of the nation, we wish you would use different words. We wish you would say, you're talking about military defense. You're talking about military means. And when you think about national security or defense of the nation, we wish you would think about what are the non-military things that contribute to the national security and to a peaceful world. And those things, when you start thinking about them, it turns out there is no military answer for them. They have to do with job creation. They have to do with commercial and trade relationships. They have to do with international cooperation. And in 1999-98, when Bridget Moix and I were visiting congressional staff to talk about this, I couldn't get the time of day. It was hard to even get a scheduled appointment with a congressional staff or a member of Congress. Now in this past year, things have changed so much that the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, has gone to the House, gone to the Senate and testified and basically said the same thing. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates basically said the same thing. We had in 2001 a West Point graduate, a guy who taught at West Point, a guy who had been General Schwarzkopf's defense intelligence liaison officer to London during the first Gulf War, come to us and say, I am so upset about this war on terrorism, an endless war. It will never get us peace. The military is the wrong tool. Will you create a job for me here at FCNL and let me work for you? So even people in the military are starting to see a different peace paradigm. So we have allies with whom to work that you wouldn't think would be allies. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not speaking to the question you're asking.
No, you are, yes. But do you feel like your understanding of what peace means, like what peace means to you or what peace means in Europe, do you feel that that's changed over the decades as you've seen others kind of claim the mantra of peace for things that aren't very peaceful?
Yeah. Well, I think for me personally, I think I probably started out thinking, well, there are peaceful people and warlike people. Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem. And I think that leads to the kind of thinking that we saw from George Bush. The problem is we're all for peace, and there's some bad people out there who aren't. Mm-hmm. So what's the answer to that problem definition? Go find them and kill them before they kill you. So you have a problem definition that is not very good or precise, and it leads to a very bad solution. I think I moved eventually to today where, although when I was doing social psychology work with patients, I didn't like the idea of behavior modification. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought somehow behavior modification was not the way to go. But with nation states and with our government in particular, more and more I'm convinced you don't persuade the powers and principalities first to be peaceful, and then they figure out how to be peaceful. You modify their behavior by constraining what they can do, and then they find other ways to behave, and they say, oh, that works. And actually, that's okay. That's not so bad. Mm-hmm. And so just to give an example, you create a national, international process that constrains nations from using landmines, anti-personnel landmines. Mm-hmm. And the United States refuses to sign the treaty and refuses to ratify it, of course. But the fact of the international treaty leads to their never using anti-personnel landmines and complying with most parts of the treaty and putting money into landmine removal and landmine survivor assistance. Mm-hmm. And it changes the behavior of the state. It changes the behavior of the military. Mm-hmm. And you do that, and then they become accustomed to it, and they start acting differently. Mm-hmm. And so the pathway to peace is different than what I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. So back in 1990, on December 23rd, to be exact, on the McNeil-Lehrer-Nisar, you were asked...
Oh, gosh, does he do research?
You were asked to talk about the U.S. military's humanitarian intervention in Somalia.
Right.
Right. And... you had kind of argued for unarmed humanitarian groups to be involved more than the military.
Right.
And so I guess I wanted to kind of mention that, but then also kind of talk about the present. Right now in Afghanistan, much of the humanitarian aid that's provided is kind of bundled into kind of the military's kind of ongoing work. to offer it security and protection. So there's been a militarization, in a way, of humanitarian aid.
There has been.
Yeah. And is right. that something that's troubling for you?
Very troubling. Yeah. You know, since probably before Kant, but then after Kant, there was this building over centuries of international law and the rules of war. And the international humanitarian law developed a distinction between the military and civilians. And I think this distinction is a pillar of international law. And the United States is doing everything possible to destroy that pillar. And you saw this long before the Afghan war, like in the 1990s, going back to when you mentioned, I was in discussions with, well, there's the War College, and the War College prepares colonels who have been identified as, these are people who are going to be generals. And they have symposium and seminars, and they meet with all kinds of people, including people like me. And we were in a room like this with probably 30 colonels. And every one of them, you could already see what was the military strategy. We were all talking about civilian-military cooperation, which now has been reified in the PRTs in Afghanistan.
What's a PRT?
Provincial Reconstruction Teams. And a Provincial Reconstruction Team is in a province, and it's composed of the military, and it's composed of civilian contractors. And the idea is the military goes in, creates a military shield. The contractors go in behind them and build schools or water treatment or irrigation things. And this is how you build peace. Peace is built through these civilian-military cooperation. Well, what you find out is it all falls apart as soon as they leave. And why? It's because it's been imposed through military force. Mm-hmm. And the civilian component of this has been separated from the people on the ground, the civilians who live in those places. And tremendous resentments are built up. So it isn't going to work anyway. And you could see that any practitioner of on-the-ground development in developing countries would know that from the beginning. But the PRTs are a key component of the U.S. operation in Afghanistan. And going back to the Somalia case, George Herbert Walker Bush said to U.S. military forces who were being sent to Somalia at the time, "You are doing God's work." And Robin McNeil, you know, said to me, "This is what the president has said. What do you think?" And I said, "No, the United States has always taken this moral view that they were doing God's work when they were taking Indian children away from their parents. They were saving these children from their savage parents and their savage community. Or when they went to Nicaragua in the 1800s, they were doing God's work. Or in the Philippines, they were doing..." No, this isn't God's work. And if you look at those instances and then think about now, you would realize that that isn't the case. So a lot of people have been excited about Three Cups of Tea and Greg Mortensen because his experience on the ground with people in Afghanistan has not relied on military muscle and has relied on developing a respectful relationship with the society and the leaders as they are. And that's worked. And even military people are beginning to recognize that.
So. I have another question, then I'll let you ask.
And we got to open it up to
So when I look back on the history of FCNL, you know, in 1991, you guys took a strong stand against the Gulf, the first Gulf War.
Right.
After September 11th, you had signs that said war is not the answer.
Right.
But I've also seen in some of your speeches and talks that you've given a discourse that talks about how America is often caught up in an endless war.
Yeah.
41% of its budget is spent on military
right.
expenditures. So with all that as a backdrop, right, on the one hand, your commitment to peace and demilitarization, on the other hand, kind of this understanding that America has a peculiar love relationship with war.
Right.
Why should there be a U.S. Institute of Peace? Why is that something that you take seriously? What does it mean for a country that's always at war to have an Institute of Peace? Like, why is it that you support that, and what do you understand that Institute of Peace to be?
Yeah. Well, that's a complicated question. Why would FCNL support a U.S. Institute of Peace? And there's two ways to answer that. We don't, and we do. we've been very skeptical about creating a U.S. Institute of Peace or a U.S. Academy of Peace or a U.S. Department of Peace because our ultimate project is to make the Department of State the Institute of Peace, to have the government itself be that. And we think that it's extremely naive to think that you can create something that has a name, Institute of Peace, and that it will be that when you know the president is going to name a certain number of boards of directors and the Senate is going to name a certain number of boards of directors, and they're not going to name me, they're not going to name other people who were prominent in the peace movement and think they know something, but they're going to name people who are willing to support the party line. And there's a bipartisan party line that peace is achieved through military strength, not through peace, not through peaceful means. On the other hand, right now, we would support continuing the U.S. Institute of Peace, funding it, because over the years, despite all the flaws that we would see in it, we've seen them do very useful, constructive things, create conversations among leaders of ethnic groups in the Balkans, but create safe spaces for them to meet each other and talk with each other. Create a space for somebody from Rwanda who really understands the situation to write a book that would actually further understanding about the situation in Rwanda or Sudan. Create interreligious discussions about when religion goes evil, what do you do about that? And how can religion be a constructive force for peace rather than a destructive force for war? And give you another example. John Limbert was a hostage in Iran. And he was a hostage for over 400 days. I can't remember what the total days were. 400 and some days, so more than a year. And at one point, he was put into a chair with a gun to his head and was told he was going to be executed. As a U.S. Foreign Service officer, U.S. Embassy, right after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. He spent about a year, I think it was, at USIP a couple years ago, writing about his experiences and also writing about U.S.-Iran relations and creating a roadmap for a peacefully negotiated settlement over a period of time between the United States and Iran and saying war isn't the answer here. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy teaches at the Naval Academy. And he's had these horrible experiences, and out of his experience, he's had this epiphany. And he really does understand. USIP is a venue for that. So that's why we would support U.S. Institute of Peace continuing, even though it doesn't fulfill our idea of what peace is.
So when we were filming the Perpetual Peace film at the United Nations, one Under Secretary General, assistant to Ban Ki-moon, had explained that he thinks about change not on the level of days or years, but on the level of decades.
Yeah.
And he said that maybe the UN Charter is actually beginning to be enacted now. It's
yeah.
taken 50 years.
Yeah.
Is that how you think about these issues? When you talk about like the State Department as one day being peaceful, I mean, it's a really interesting proposition, but it seems like wish fulfillment. That's not what it's meant to be.
Yeah.
And although it may have done good things, it's also not necessarily thought of in that yeah. way. So what's like how do you negotiate these different goals? Like, what's the temporal?
Right. Connection? Well, the first thing my predecessor Ed Snyder said to me when I replaced him at FCL is that he came into Washington D.C. thinking on a 2-year timeline what he wanted to accomplish, and he left Washington D.C. saying to himself, I've learned that things don't happen on my timeline. They happen on God's timeline, which is much longer. But, interesting, his entire career was spent trying to end the Cold War. And he retired the night of November 9th, 1989. And when we had our television on and the Berlin Wall came down. And he actually had something to do with the end of the Cold War. I do think things happen on a long timeline, and what concerns me is that I really think we can move U.S. national security apparatus to a position of peace is accomplished through peaceful means. What I'm afraid of is that it can't be done before the heated planet ends the whole project. And I'm very concerned that human beings and certainly the U.S. Congress are not equipped to deal with a heated planet. Here we are, I think, we have a situation where hydrocarbon civilization is finished. Mm-hmm. And it's not a question whether we're going to have a hydrocarbon civilization or not. We're not going to have one. It's a question, how are we going to end it? Are we going to end it by moving into a sustainable civilization, or are we going to end it in catastrophe?
So then why... I mean, it's interesting to hear you say this because it conforms with a lot of... It resembles a lot of the reports and other documents I've been reading that suggest that the wars of the future will not be fought over weapons as much as over water, for instance.
Yeah, right.
Over scarcity of resources,
right.
Global warming, etc. So then why is so much of your work right now focused on kind of militarization when perhaps scarcity resource and underdevelopment are
yeah.
perhaps something that's going to generate future conflict more?
Well, actually, I used to focus a lot more in my work on militarization. Like, I helped to found and start something called the Arms Transfer Working Group, which focused on conventional weapons, and been very active in the Nuclear Weapons Working Group, which was working for nuclear disarmament, and very active working on trying to reduce military budget. But in the last 15 years, I actually made a shift in my work to focus much more on trying to create the tools of peaceful prevention of deadly conflict as a parallel security system to the military. And I've been trying to work very hard with practitioners of peaceful prevention of deadly conflict to ask them, please, could they pay more attention to what were the future conflicts going to be as a result of global warming? And I think we're making some headway there. We're making some success with the civil society organizations that deal with peaceful prevention taking on more of the global warming issues. And you mentioned some of them. But in addition to that, climate changes that come as a result of the heated planet are probably going to result in mass migrations of people, and that's probably going to create tremendous conflict. And it's not just social dislocation, but probably violent conflict. And we need to anticipate that, figure out how do we deal with that peacefully rather than wait until it happens. And I have said a number of times that think most scholars of conflict who look at conflict curves see it as a bell curve. And they see a conflict beginning, and it can be social, economic, cultural, religious, ethnic, combination of all those things, and it builds, it escalates and escalates. And when it gets to the top of that bell curve, it will go lethal, and people get killed. And it can be very, very ugly. And then eventually the killing diminishes or stops, and then you get a decline in the curve, just like a bell curve. And what they find is that the most effective time to intervene to prevent deadly violence is in the curve up or in the curve down, and the least effective time to intervene is at the top of the curve. And in fact, if you intervene at the top of the curve, in a lot of these cases that they've looked at, it's made things worse. And so I think on global warming, we're looking at emerging conflicts, which are going to be social, economic, cultural, religious, ethnic. We have time now to intervene and do something about it. If we wait, it will be too late to do anything effective.
One more question. I'm fascinated by, but also deeply troubled by, extra legal sites, Guantanamo being an example.
Yeah.
I'm also fascinated by how in the Arab world and in Europe there have been a variety of de-radicalization programs, and one doesn't find those here in the United States. Are you interested in this question of de-radicalization? Could you imagine America supporting that kind of work?
Yeah. Tell me more about de-radicalization.
There's been a number of reports that International Peace Institute and others have done on in these kind of situations that we now all find ourselves in. There's been a provisional kind of support in the Arab world and in Europe for de-radicalizing terrorists and others, and trying to invest in other approaches to reintegrating extreme positions into kind of normal life.
Right.
But you don't really, it doesn't seem like there's any interest in that in the U.S. military, but it would be another way that one could diffuse, let's say, conflict.
Just to be flip, I'll appropriate paraphrase Gandhi. Remember, a Western journalist asked him, what do you think about Western civilization? And he said, I think it would be a good idea. And if you say, what do I think about de-radicalization, I think it would be good idea here. Mm-hmm. The radicalization is happening here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, but you know what I mean. We mean these extremists who are using violence to attack us. If Americans paid attention to the radicalization process, they would be astounded to find out that their own government promoted it and paid for it. And I think most Americans think, my God, where did Al-Qaeda come from? Where did Osama bin Laden come from? And I think they don't know that it came from the Carter administration and the Reagan administration, thinking that it would be a good idea to bog down the Soviet Union in a land war in Afghanistan, and that it came from U.S. CIA Director William Casey, Prince Faisal Turkey in Saudi Arabia, and officers in the ISI in Pakistan saying, well, as we support Mujahideen and warlords to fight the Soviet Union, it would be very good if we had a religious contingent from the Arab states to help them. Because ideologically, we can paint Soviet Union as godless communism, godless empire, and we can appeal to most of the people in the world who are religious, and they'll support them. And so they tried to find a Saudi prince who would lead this religious contingent, and they couldn't get one to do it. And so they got the next best thing, which was a Yemeni person, and it was Osama bin Laden. And I think the American people don't realize how involved their tax dollars were in radicalizing people, because at the time it looked like a good idea. Mm-hmm. Now it doesn't look so good, but now that it doesn't look so good, nobody wants to remember. And nobody will take responsibility for it, except, to his credit, Charlie Wilson, who was one of the architects of that. He publicly took responsibility, said, okay, that was a mistake. So de-radicalization, good idea, but take the moat out of your own eye. Take the timber out of your own eye before you take the moat out of the other person's eye. And this problem of law-free zones, I think, is terrible. And here is the United States, who all through the Cold War promoted human rights and law. And then after the Cold War ends and you get into this endless war, the United States starts creating law-free zones.
So how do you guys in your work negotiate a situation which is extra legal, but somehow one has to resort to legal means to resolve? So what's your position, for instance, on Guantanamo?
We think Guantanamo should be closed, and we think that all of the people at Guantanamo should have the benefit of the rule of law and have their rights as human beings.
Immediately.
Right. Yeah. And we think that that's not only for their benefit, but for the benefit of a democratic society. Mm-hmm. If we don't do that, then the extreme violent radicals who attacked us have gotten their way. Mm-hmm. They've turned us into the very thing they wanted to turn us into, and we should not permit that. And I was in discussions in Washington before Guantanamo was set up that way, where I heard legal scholars talking about what would be the consequences of how people who would be captured in Afghanistan would be treated legally. And the legal community in those discussions, it seemed to me, broke down. There were people who were constitutionalists and said, you have to, if you're going to torture them, that's wrong, but if you do it, then you also have to accept the fact you'll never be able to adjudicate their case because it'll be thrown out. That's a choice you're going to make. And there were other ones who said, no, we have another choice we could make. We could torture them, and then we could imprison and punish them if we create places where U.S. law doesn't apply. And they're the ones who prevailed. And I think it was a terrible tragedy.
Another question. So a few months back, at Haverford College, I heard Mark Danner speak, who has been quite vocal in opposing torture and critiquing Bush and Obama on their endorsement of torture on some underlying fundamental level. As a former New York Times bureau chief, he also spoke about the complicated relationship that much of the media has now with the military. They're embedded, and in a variety of ways, much of their perspectives and coverage emanates from a close relationship that they need to have the story first, etc. So how do you arrive at informed decisions today? How do you arrive at a policy position given that there's so much misinformation or kind of complicated ways in which these kind of public stories find their public form?
Yeah, I think this the diminishment of the independent press, the elimination pretty much of a seasoned cadre of foreign correspondents, the downsizing to almost nothing of investigative journalists has had a very bad effect on the democratic process for the very reasons that you mentioned. And it's very indicative that the Pentagon learned its lessons through Vietnam, and they're never going to have a draft, and they're never going to have an independent press going out looking at an area of conflict if they can prevent it. And they have a lot of levers to prevent it. How do we get by with that? I think we have actually gotten by it, and we did it by saying, consider the source, by saying we cannot rely on what the embedded press says. We can look at it and we know, okay, that's the official view. And it may be officials within the government who are critical of the official view, but it's still the official view. And we have to have our own sources. And one of the wonderful things about a lot of different organizations, Human Rights Watch, Oxfam, American Friends Service Committee, Mennonite Central Committee, is for decades, and Catholics, Catholic Social Services, World Jewish Relief, you could just mention a whole bunch of groups. They have had people on the ground in countries all over the world, and they know the communities. And so we would go to them. And that has been one of the wonderful things about the internet. We can get pretty fast feedback from people by email. And it has helped us to not be bamboozled by the embedded press.
Is there a military intervention that you could support? Or just there would be no such thing?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Do you remember Ron Dellums? He was a member of Congress from Berkeley, California. It was called the People's Republic of Berkeley. And he got elected during the Vietnam War. And he was in Congress way into the 90s, so 30-some years. A really great guy, I think. He was a Marine veteran and the only member of Congress who declared himself as committed in principle to nonviolence. And he was also he's an African-American man, and he was considered perhaps one of the four best orators in the history of Congress. He was just brilliant. And we were good friends, and the Balkan Wars were going on, and a point came where the UN, because of the veto situation at the UN Security Council, could not agree on deploying a peacekeeping force in the Balkans. And Ron called me over, and we had a consultation with his staff and my staff, and said, you know, we're both committed to nonviolence, we're both peace movement people, but our responsibility is to try to prevent civilians being killed, to protect civilians. And the options here are so narrowed down, what to do. What are we going to say? And he said, he made a proposal. He said, I want to call for a NATO force to be deployed. And I want to do it in a way that says, not for the purpose of warfighting. Should be deployed for the purpose of preventing war fighting. And if it's going to prevent war fighting, it is going to have to be bigger, stronger, more robust than any fighting force there. And what do you say about that? And I said, yeah, I agree. Let's argue to do that. And there could be problems with it if they get into war fighting, but we're going to support that. So he and I both supported that proposal, and that was done. Now, when Clinton went a step and I think it worked, by the way. I think that part of it worked. When Clinton then went forward to bombing in Kosovo, I went to Clinton's driveway at the White House and sat down and got arrested and said, you know, that's terrible. Now, here's an interesting... we've got to stop because it's time for people to move on, but I've got to tell you this one little story. We had good relations with Clinton and had meetings at the White House with his staff, sometimes with him, but I said, I'm going to do this anyway. I don't care about that relation. This is important enough, and he'll probably never have me back. So went and got arrested. Didn't know what was going to happen. And some weeks later, he had Maureen Shea, his liaison to the religious community, call me up and say, ask Joe if he would bring religious leaders to the White House. I'll meet them in the Rose Garden, and we'll do a big press conference about why we need to pass the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I'll be there. And we showed up, and he was very civil, and, you know, so some things we disagree, some things we agree.